Hello and welcome to another episode of Damn Interesting Week. We are so glad you've decided to join us. My name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And this was a damn interesting week. So let's get started with our first link.
First link.
All right. From Nature, we got to give AI credit where it's due, because right now it is being put to use unlocking ancient texts, and it is doing a hell of a job.
All right.
It's doing so well. And by it, I also mean the amazing human researchers that are wielding it appropriately and properly. But
Right. What
it's able to do right now is kind of mind-blowing and positions us at a cusp of rediscovering ancient and forgotten history at a scale that we may not have seen in this generation. We're going to start with an email from October 2023 that showed up on one Federica Nicolardi's phone, and it had an image on it that would effectively transform her research forever. It was a fragment of a papyrus scroll that had been burnt in the eruption of Mount Vesuvius in AD 79. Now, this burnt scroll was one of hundreds discovered in the realms of a luxury Roman villa in Italy. We've had attempts over the centuries to peel apart the scroll's fragile carbonized layers, but that actually left a lot of them in pieces. They kind of disintegrated with the touch. So Nicolardi, who is a papyrologist at the University of Naples in Italy, she had been enlisted in an effort to use AI to read the unreadable. And now the latest results had arrived. So in the 2010s, we had some early attempts to apply deep learning to ancient texts. And the models that we called convolutional neural networks, or CNNs, they're inspired by visual neuroscience. They've used these kinds of models to fill in images of eroded lettering and piece together broken fragments. But there's another type of neural network, recurrent neural networks, RNNs. Those are designed to tackle sequences of data in which the linear order matters. Now, those have begun to show huge potential for searching, translating, and filling in gaps in texts that have already been transcribed. Now, classicists, when it comes to interpreting new sources, they do that by using their knowledge of similar existing texts, right? They're generally specialists on works from a particular time and place. So one person can't be on top of all sources potentially relevant to a new text. But that's just the kind of challenge that machine learning models could help with. So what the researchers initially did was they trained an RNN-based model called Pythia on tens of thousands of Greek inscriptions written between 7th century BC and 5th century AD. They followed up in 2022 with a model called Ithaca, but this time the researchers took advantage of a breakthrough in machine learning called the Transformer model, which captures more complex language patterns than an RNN is able to by analyzing different characteristics of an input. And in the tests that they ran since then, Ithaca restored artificially produced gaps in ancient texts with 62% accuracy. And that's compared with 25% on human-only experts.
If they're missing, how do they know they're accurate?
Well, I think that she's saying they artificially took some chunks out to test how good it was.
Okay.
Exactly. And they wanted to see, like, you know, machine alone, human alone, people with a machine. And there's another fascinating use case that's worth mentioning here. And for that, we go to South Korea, where they have a very different challenge because they've got one of the world's largest historical archives. They have detailed daily records with hundreds of thousands of articles covering the reigns of 27 Korean kings. Here's the thing, hardly anyone can read them because they're written in Hanja, which is an ancient writing system that uses Chinese characters, but is different than modern Chinese or Korean. Now, a small team of government translators is working to translate the text into modern Korean manually, but Based on what the AI is spitting out, the human specialists rated the AI translations, descriptions of events like state visits, punishments of traitors, musical concerts. And they said that what the AI came out with was significantly more accurate and readable than the archaic ones, and in some cases, better than the modern translation. So, yay, AI in the powerful hands of smart scientists. I'm into it.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing about AI, which is that in the hands of experts, who, even if you only have a 75% accuracy, an expert can gauge those and get much further along in the task at scale. Because now, you know, in the past, it was, okay, an expert, I guess, has an intuition or just randomly chooses a papyrus where they're like, that seems interesting. And then they spend, I don't know, hours, months trying to translate it. Mm-hmm. Whereas at least the AI can help us
focus. Be like, these are all shopping lists. Don't look at them.
Just- Like, these are the general shape of shopping lists. You probably don't care about these. Yeah. But I mean, it is fascinating because the AI almost has its own kind of like, I mean, I don't want to get too deep into linguistics, whatever stuff, but I saw a Reddit post that was saying that they used an AI model to basically decipher what a bunch of squirrels were talking about. And and they're like, well, they argue about food. And one of them, you know, constantly hitting on another squirrel. And like, it was like very human stuff.
Well, maybe once we actually get AI to universally translate all living creatures, I don't know, maybe the reality TV gets better.
Yeah, I mean, I'd rather watch a drama of squirrels fighting than people fighting. So, for
I would love to watch Shark Tank, but it's actual sharks.
There you go.
So bloody. All right, next link.
Next link.
This article comes to us from Ars Technica. It's titled, Judge Ends Man's 11-Year Quest to Dig Up Landfill and Recover $765 million in Bitcoin.
Oh, he's been ordered to let the dream die.
Yeah. So you may have heard about this story because this has been going on since 2013. James Howells has been hoping to recover a laptop hard drive that he says contains the private key for cryptocurrency, which he mined in 2009. Ars Technica actually wrote about it at the time, noting that the value of a Bitcoin had just passed $1,000, making 7,500 Bitcoins worth $7.5 million. The alleged number of Bitcoins has changed a bit, with Howells now saying he lost 8,000 Bitcoins, and the Bitcoin price exceeded $100,000 last month, and was well worth over $95,636 as of this writing, that is January 10th on this article, or $765 million for 8,000 Bitcoins. Kind of a painful loss. So, High Court Judge Kaiser Casey issued his ruling yesterday, siding with the defendant in Howells versus Newport City Council. Howells sought, quote, an order that the defendant either deliver the hard drive or allow his team of experts to excavate the landfill in order to find it, and in the alternative, compensation equivalent to the value of the Bitcoin that he can no longer access. Which, wow. Talk about audacity.
Yeah.
So, the council said that excavating the landfill site would let harmful substances escape into the environment, which raises public health issues and environmental concerns, the ruling said. The judge found no reasonable grounds for bringing this case, saying it has no realistic prospect of succeeding if it went to trial, and that there is no other compelling reason why it should be disposed of at trial. This ruling quotes the Control of Pollution Act, 1974, which states that anything delivered to the authority by another person in the course of using the facilities shall belong to the authority and may be dealt with accordingly. Howells, quote, submitted that section 14.6c merely says that anything so delivered shall belong to the authority, but does not say that it shall cease to belong to its former owner.
All right.
Which, The judge disagreed, writing that the words shall belong to the authority are unqualified and unrestricted. The claim is also barred by the 6-year statute of limitations because Howells knew the facts material to his claim by November 2013, but did not commence proceedings until May 2024, according to the ruling. So, after his November 2013 outreach, Howells made repeated requests to the defendant for access to the site in order to find and retrieve the hard drive, but these were largely ignored by the defendant. The claimant then set about securing investment to enable a team of experts to undertake a landfill excavation and recovery operation, and in 2023, he began to advance his case formally to the defendant. The BBC yesterday quoted Howells as saying, "It's not about greed. I'm happy to share the proceeds, but nobody in a position of power will have a decent conversation with me. This ruling has taken everything from me and left me with nothing. It's the great British injustice system striking again." Which, you know, I get it. But also, like, you got to be realistic, right? I mean, yeah. Even with a team of experts, the landfill contains around 350,000 tons of waste, and another 50,000 is added annually. Once the skip at the reception area is full, the waste is emptied into the landfill, where it's then covered with inert material to minimize the releases of gases or liquids, and then compacted. As for how the hard drive went to the landfill, Howells claims it was taken from his home without his permission or consent on the morning of August 5th, 2013. His ex-girlfriend, Halfina Eddie Evans, said in a recent interview with the Daily Mail that she brought the hard drive and other unwanted belongings to the dump at Howells' request. Quote, "I thought he should be running his errands, not me, but I did it to help out. I'd love nothing more than for him to find it. I'm sick and tired of hearing about it."
Yeah.
So the ruling describes Howells' version of the 2013 event. In his drawers, he found two hard drives. One was the hard drive, capitalized, and the other was a blank hard drive that contained no data. He meant to throw out the blank hard drive, but instead he mistakenly picked up the hard drive and put it into one of the black bin liners. He then left the two bin bags downstairs in his house and asked his partner at the time to take them to the landfill at the site the following day after completing the school run. However, she said that she did not want to take the black bin bags to the site and refused to do so. The claimant was not overly concerned at her refusal because he decided that on the following morning he would check to make sure he had put the correct hard drive in the bin bags.
Ugh.
However, when he awoke at 9 o'clock the following morning, he found that his partner had had a change of heart and had already taken the bin bags and manually deposited them into the general waste bins at the site. Which is a very movie plot in a way, right? Where it's just like, oh, you know, don't worry about it. Wait, you actually took it after all?
Well, and if you even half suspected you might have put the wrong hard drive in there, why would you be like, I'll check it tomorrow?
Yeah.
Also, there's better ways to get rid of your e-waste than just throwing it in the dump.
Yeah. Yes. This is his punishment for putting electronics in the landfill in the first place.
Yep. That is a good point. I don't know how the UK handles electronics, but I imagine they do something similar to us.
Probably better than us, I would hope.
Yeah. So I appreciate the systematic nature of his approach, but it's just like, sometimes you just got to know when to let that $765 million go.
Sometimes, yeah.
I have a feeling in the next year or so, we're going to hear another story about him getting arrested for breaking in.
Landfill Avenger.
That's right. Yeah.
Although, honestly, I would totally watch like an Ocean's 11 style movie about breaking into and excavating a landfill. There's potential there.
Or the girlfriend has had it all along. She never threw it out and she's just waiting.
Imagine. Just waiting for him to fully lose his mind.
Right.
Next link.
Next link.
This is from Nautilus. Bringing some hard science to y'all today.
Ooh.
Why do some people look like their dogs? So I'm going to start with an anecdotal story. Many years ago, I was in the vet with my pit bull. I have very square jaws. And there was two other couples in there. And one of the couples just starts laughing hysterically. And I look over to them and they show me that every single one of us in there looked exactly like our dogs.
Yeah.
It was pretty remarkable. And if you've ever seen 101 Dalmatians, they play off the same idea with the look-alike pairs of people.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a fabulous book of people who look like their dogs in New York. wonderful. Like the person with the Afghan, she's got really long hair. It's beautiful. But what is really behind this impression? Do we think that dogs resemble their owners because we only tend to notice and remember such extraordinary instances? This is called, by the way, availability heuristic.
Mm-hmm.
We forget what's unremarkable. Psychologist Jana Bender and her colleagues at the Friedrich Schiller University in Germany decided to find out. They recently conducted a systematic review of studies probing for similarities in dog-human dyads and found that people actually resemble their dogs more often than chance would predict.
Mm.
Not just in physical characteristics, but also in personality and behavior.
Oh.
That one tracks more, but that we'll get to that. Their research, which analyzed 15 studies, was published in the Journal of Personality and Individual Differences. It turns out that when you give people shuffled pictures of dogs and their owners, they are consistently good at guessing which human owns which dog.
Nice.
This finding held across four separate studies, even when the mouths of the dogs and owners were hidden. So just the eyes.
Hmm.
In one study, test subjects were only able to match purebred dogs with their owners. However, in a more objective measure, overweight dogs were found to be more likely to have owners with high body mass indexes.
Mm-hmm.
Two hypotheses could explain such resemblances. The first is that dog owners choose dogs that resemble them,
mm-hmm.
probably subconsciously. This possibility is supported by a couple of studies that show that women with long hairstyles express greater preferences for long-eared dog breeds, such as beagles and Springer Spaniels, while those with short hairstyles tend to prefer the short-eared breeds, like Huskies and Basenjis. Dog owners in general might do this because of a general finding that people prefer others who resemble themselves,
mm-hmm.
or because of the mere exposure effect, which is that people prefer things that are familiar.
Mm-hmm.
The second possibility is that dogs and humans become more similar in appearance over time. However, if this were happening, owners should resemble their dogs more when they've been with the dog longer.
Mm.
But the researchers suggest people's abilities to match owners with their dogs in photographs is not affected by how long the owners have had the dog.
Mm.
The only resemblance that seems to grow with this time is weight.
Right.
Oh, no.
Oh, right.
Mm-hmm. Well, that makes sense. I mean, it's like if this is what food is in the house and what your eating habits are, that one completely makes sense to me.
Yeah.
Those dogs are getting a lot more snacks.
Yeah.
Definitely. The similarities between dogs and their owners didn't end with just appearance. And this one makes more sense to me. Bender and her colleagues found multiple studies that showed significant correlations between dogs and their owners in all five major personality dimensions: neuroticism, extroversion, openness, agreeableness, and conscientiousness. Dog owners who rated themselves as emotionally unstable had dogs who showed higher rates of aggression towards their owners and more strangers.
Mm-hmm.
So they directed that fear. Only one of the eight studies the team reviewed found weak correlations between dogs and human personalities. But the researchers note that the study looked only at owners who had adopted their dogs within the past 2 months. So the dogs hadn't had enough time to become as neurotic as the owner. They proposed that emotional mirroring between pets and owners, again, evolve over time. So for me, again, that makes sense. It's the visual that is still perplexing.
Yeah. I mean, there's an ego there. You want a dog that looks like you because you, on some level, like how you look. I mean, that makes sense to me.
Yeah. And it's a somewhat subconscious, right? It wasn't like I was picking a square jawed dog. It's like, that dog looks like me.
But there's something in your brain that goes, yeah, I like that. Like, that looks good.
So if you think you look and act like your dog, you're right. Except for boxer people, I'm sorry, I don't want to say you look like your dogs.
Right. There's certain breeds you want to be like, except you. Just, it's okay. Don't worry.
It's okay.
Even if it's a little short nose, you've got that sleek Corvette body. You know, you win some, you lose some, right?
Yeah, you can find some traits. Yeah.
Next link.
Next link.
All right, this next one comes from Smithsonian Mag, and it's called Archaeologists Discover Intricately Decorated Tomb Belonging to a Doctor Who Treated Egyptian Pharaohs 4,100 Years Ago.
Oh!
And one of the reasons I found this one fascinating is it's the first time I've ever heard of an Egyptian tomb, like a big one, not just like a burial ground, for someone who wasn't some level of royalty, right? Or a great military leader.
Right. The only other one is the guy who built all the pyramids. He got a nice...
Oh, did he? That's nice. Mm-hmm. Blue collar tombs are rare. This guy wasn't blue collar. He was a doctor.
Right.
But I mean, even a white collar tomb, it's still kind of unusual.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that's because this guy was a really special doctor. So according to a statement from Egypt's Ministry of Tourism and Antiquities, a team of French and Swiss researchers discovered this tomb in Saqqara, which is the necropolis of the ancient capital city of Memphis. If you're not familiar, a necropolis was sort of a designated cemetery city that was kept separate but nearby to actual cities throughout antiquity. Egypt had the most of them, but the word is actually Greek, which, by the way, means that the plural is necropoles, apparently. And while we do normally associate the term with antiquity, some modern cemeteries are actually reclaiming the word necropolis, especially in places that use a lot of above-ground tombs because the land underneath is unsuitable, including waterlogged New Orleans or the very rocky Glasgow. So you can visit a modern day necropolis if that's your thing. Anyway, inside this doctor's tomb in Saqqara, researchers found a stone sarcophagus bearing the name Tetinabafu in hieroglyphics, and the inscriptions indicate that he was the chief palace physician, priest, chief dentist, director of medicinal plants, and conjurer of the goddess Serket, who was known for curing venomous snake and scorpion bites. They believe he may have served under Pepi II, a pharaoh of the Old Kingdom around the 23rd century BCE, who is also buried in a pyramid at Saqqara and ruled for somewhere between 60 and 90 years, which obviously he was able to live that long because he apparently had a really good doctor. The researchers said that they didn't find any specific medical items in the tomb because most of Saqqara has been looted repeatedly over the last several thousand years, but the walls of the tomb were extensively decorated with pictures of tools of the trade and various jars and vases of medicines. They said both the content of the paintings as well as their size and preservation are enough to make the tomb a, quote, exceptional find. Research team leader Philippe Colombert also noted that the titles inscribed on the doctor's tomb are unusual both in their rarity and the sheer number of them. Being a conjurer of the goddess Serket, for example, means that he was a bite specialist, which not a lot of people were, while director of medicinal plants has only been found on one other ancient Egyptian artifact. Being labeled a dentist is also exceedingly rare in this time period, and when you do find one, it's obvious that dentistry was all he did. You know, these guys definitely tended to specialize, so it's very unique to find a guy who was all of the above.
Mm. Right, this was like their Benjamin Franklin.
Yeah, exactly. He was the Leonardo da Vinci of ancient Egypt. But, you know, they are quick to remind everyone that while Tetinabafu was clearly a cut above the rest, we should not be thinking that the ancient Egyptians didn't have medical care in general. They were extremely advanced compared to the rest of the world at that time, and we have evidence of them doing surgery to treat brain tumors and the ability to diagnose diabetes, as well as the development of some pretty advanced prosthetics. So the Egyptians were doing good overall, but Tetinabafu was doing better, and clearly that's why he got to be personal physician to the pharaoh. Unless it's all a lie, but I suspect that job title inflation wasn't necessarily a thing.
Yeah, that's a lot of work to do for a lie.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you're paying that engraver per letter. So next link.
Next link.
All right, for something completely different, we go to Vice, where they report a woman's tonsils grew back 40 years after she had them removed.
What?
That seems unfair.
Like, yeah. We're in that timeline, though, so awareness is preparedness?
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe you just will escape the fate that dear Katie Golden had, because in 1983, when she was 5 years old, she had her tonsils removed. This is a super common procedure. It went totally smoothly, and decades later, she is preparing for her second tonsillectomy.
See, okay, I've heard of them regrowing like in the year or two afterwards because they missed some of the tissue. I've never heard of it happening 40 years after the fact. That's crazy.
Yeah, and tonsils don't usually do this. And that's really descriptive of most of the human body, right?
We don't intend to grow back.
We don't have lizard tail magic yet. So, but while this is uncommon, it's not impossible. Now, there are a few different ways that we remove tonsils. There's, prepare yourself, microdebridement, coblation, and the ominous-sounding cold technique, which is just another way of describing the tried-and-true method of slicing them out with a scalpel. But we don't use the cold technique nearly as much as we used to because of problems just like this. Because there's a chance the surgeon will only partially remove the problematic tonsil, which, in rare cases, like dear Katie Golden, can in fact lead to regrowth. Now, the coblation method is a high-frequency electrosurgery where the tonsil tissue is destroyed. And this is what Dr. Hayes used on Golden for tonsillectomy number two.
So tonsils are like a cancer in a way? Like they're just going to, like, because, you know, it's kind of the same with cancer. If you don't cut it all out, it...
Right, it regenerates, yeah.
Regenerates itself. Like, what's the point of tonsils?
I guess it's just the human body program and be like, wait, didn't we have tonsils? We had tonsils. I know when we started it off, we were
supposed to have these things. Somebody misplaced them. Now I got to regrow them.
Next link?
Next link!
This article comes to us from Vice as well. We're all adults here, right? We know what Vice is
like.
Last
I checked. I mean,
yes. So, okay, here's the title. UK woman hospitalized after sex triggered her nut allergy.
Oh, okay, dear.
Yeah. Of course, the article itself leads with nut is a common way to refer to male ejaculation. And what, this is a story. This is
they
a story.
They have to explain it. Like, come on.
Yeah. You know that the editor and the writer were debating on whether that had to be the lead to the article.
Yeah.
Wow.
And this is a story about a woman whose nut allergy was triggered by having sex. Feel free to make all the nut allergy jokes you want. Get them out of your system. Okay, now we can proceed. So, a 20-year-old woman in the UK experienced a severe allergic reaction after unprotected vaginal sex with a guy with whom she was in a monogamous long-term relationship. She knew she had an allergy to Brazil nuts, and she knew that her partner had eaten some a few hours earlier, but he made sure to bathe and clean his teeth and under his fingernails before they had sex. So where was the allergic reaction coming from? If you think it's the dirty joke, it actually is. It was his semen. Yes.
Oh, no!
So after visiting the hospital, her doctor suspected that her partner's semen had traces of the Brazil nut allergens triggering her allergic response.
Oh, my God.
The doctors conducted a skin prick test. Also, feel free to get your prick-related jokes out now, using her partner's semen sample. One sample was collected before he ate the Brazil nuts, and the other sample was collected 2.5 hours after eating some. And the test using the post-nut sample resulted in a visible allergy reaction on her skin, confirming that the Brazil nut allergies were the cause and her partner's semen was the delivery system. You might say the results finally provided her with post-nut clarity.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, that's in the article. Just had to include it.
So she needs to find a different partner, because if she has that much of a reaction to Brazil nuts and he's still eating Brazil nuts.
Yeah, he's the wrong guy.
Yeah.
Come on, dude.
I mean, I assume this is the first time they encountered it through this way. But yeah, I mean, if I had a partner who was super allergic, like, you know, to peanuts or anything else, I'd be let's just not eat that. Yeah, I get your point.
He knew enough to take a shower and wash his hands thoroughly. If you're at that level of sensitivity, yeah, you just should not be bringing that into the house at all.
Period. Yeah.
And just one more note on the context of this article. It is by Luis Prada, and he says this article was written on his last day working for Vice. So
nice. Yeah.
He's going out with a bang. That's the way to go. Wow.
Next link.
Next link.
All right, I've got a quick one here from Moss and Fogg, which has apparently become more relevant than they thought it would be when they published it, called "These Fire Extinguishing Bollards Are the Wildfire Tech We've Been Hoping For."
Ooh.
So, you know, some uplifting news amidst what is happening in Los Angeles, which is not uplifting at all. The most important thing you need to know here is that fire extinguishing bollard is the generic name. The brand name for this newly designed item is the Fire Javelin.
Well, and I think most Americans, what is a bollard?
Right, exactly. But it's a simple but effective idea. Basically, it's a big heat-sensitive stick with a spike on one end so you can jam it into the ground. And then when the temperature indicates there are flames nearby, it explodes an internal reservoir of either water or flame retardant chemicals in all directions. It's kind of like if a fire extinguisher and a tiki torch had a baby, basically.
Hmm.
And it is not enough to put out a full-blown wildfire. But if you had these things stationed at regular intervals in the woods, they could potentially stop a fire in the early stages before it's able to grow, which would be useful. The design team also says they'd be light enough for firefighters to carry several of them each, potentially letting them set up a line in a specific area to create a breakpoint for an in-progress wildfire. And for the ones that are expected to be left out more permanently, they've suggested the added functionality of a light on the top of each one so they can double as guides along roads and hiking trails.
Hmm.
Which is nice, because often during a wildfire, what you really need is a route for everyone to escape.
Yeah.
Now, it's worth noting that this is purely a design concept at this stage. It's won a few awards, but it doesn't look like anyone's built a prototype yet, so no one has any idea whether this explosive action would be enough to, say, hurt a bystander, or how long before the fire javelins go bad and you have to replace them all. But it's a start, and I imagine they're in search of funding to build that prototype at this moment. So, you know, if you've got some spare venture capital lying around, you could potentially be the co-owner of Fire Javelin Incorporated, which seems cool. And I think is telling. Like, I feel like if Americans are going to address the reality of natural disasters and climate change, it needs a cool name.
Yeah.
That's the way to get us on board is marketing. So
very hashtaggable.
It does seem like Fire Javelin will cause fires, though.
But maybe that's how you get military funding. That's you're like, right. Just listen, yeah. Don't look too closely at what it is. Just look at the name and give us that money.
That's right. It's the prosumer edition.
There you go. I like that word. That is... All right. Well, that is all we have time for today. We're so glad you've joined us. Some of the articles we did not have time to get to today include Britain's Badger Wars, how a would-be bomber rebuilt his life, and astronomers discover most distant known blazar. So all that and more, plus everything we talked about today, can be found on DamnInteresting.com. If you like our podcast and want to support us, you can do so at patreon.com/DamnInteristingWeek. In the meantime, my name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And we hope you have a damn interesting week. Bye-bye.